Well, if you read Doris Kearns Goodwin's A Team of Rivals, the book on Abraham Lincoln's presidency, you know that one of the book's stars was William Seward, the president's secretary of state. Well, a new biography is out that tells a lot more of the story. It's Seward, Lincoln's Indispensable Man. The early favorite for the presidency in 1860, Seward wound up losing to the little-known senator from Illinois. And yet Seward swallowed his bitterness to become a staunch Lincoln ally and a close friend devastated by the president's assassination. William Starr is the book's author. He'll be in Kansas City next week. He joins us now from his home in New Hampshire. And Walter, good to have you. How was he Abraham Lincoln's indispensable man?
Well, he was Secretary of State, which is, of course, always an important position, particularly dealing with the potential involvement of Britain and France in the American Civil War. So that was one critical role. But he was a lot more. He was consulted by the president on military matters, on politics, the movie version of the Lincoln book showing Seward as the sort of key political man in the 13th Amendment, I think captures some of his sort of multiple roles for the president.
So without him, Walter, where would he have been?
Well, if we imagine, Lincoln without Seward as his Secretary of State, he would not have had, as adept a team. We tend to forget that Lincoln made some big personnel mistakes. I mean, his first Secretary of War, Simon Cameron, proved just totally inept as well as corrupt. It's worrisome to think of how our foreign policy might have been handled by some of the alternative candidates for Secretary of State.
So why did Lincoln then, as the newly elected president, pick his great rival to be his Secretary of State?
It wasn't as unusual in the 19th century as it is today. I mean, there was a tradition in the 19th century that kind of Secretary of State was sort of president in waiting. There were a slew of Secretaries of State who had become president, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and so it was kind of the position into which presidents slotted, this is the man that I see succeeding me. And Seward, position in the Republican Party kind of entitled him to that. He also had done a huge amount to get Lincoln elected. He had campaigned across the country.
And really put his bitterness aside to do that, right?
He had. Indeed, at one point, I toyed with starting the book with kind of the moment that Seward learns that he will not be the nominee and his understandable bitterness and disappointment and anger, and then how he kind of, over the course of the next few weeks, gets over that. There's a wonderful letter from his friend Charles Francis Adams, the son of the president, the grandson of the president, talking about how the way in which you deal with this disappointment will have more to do with your lasting fame than sort of some of your more obvious accomplishments.
And so he sort of has to get over it then. He knows he has to get over it.
He does, and he, he's a committed Republican and, feels that it would be, sort of disastrous for the country sort of have a continuation of the Democratic rule, James Buchanan. So he does, and he goes out on the campaign trail. And one of the things I intend to talk about when I'm there in a week's time at the Kansas City Library is Seward coming to not quite to Kansas City, but very close to you all to give speeches in both Missouri and Kansas.
Well, Walter Starr will talk about William Seward, as he just mentioned, and his book, Seward, Lincoln's Indispensable Man, at 6:30 next Tuesday night at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library downtown at 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. You didn't begin the book with what you might have begun the book with, which is what happened on the night that Lincoln was murdered by John Wilkes Booth. You did begin the book this way. One of Booth's co-conspirators nearly killed Lincoln. What happened there, and how close did the country come to losing all of its top leadership in a single evening, Walter?
it came, you know, closer than you know, way closer than it should have. You know, Booth was able to kill Lincoln without much difficulty. There really wasn't much of a guard around the president.
Which even today is you know, we all know that story, but it's sort of staggering given the fact the tensions of the Civil War were so great at that time. And, of course, the same would apply to Seward and to Andrew Johnson and the rest of the top leadership of his administration.
Right. Johnson, you know, was just staying in a hotel room. The person assigned the task of assassinating him had a hotel room, you know, immediately adjacent to that of Johnson. It would have been not at all difficult. The man assigned that task simply lost his nerve. He went and had a drink and then another drink. And Grant was actually supposed to go to the theater with Lincoln. He decided kind of at the last minute he wanted to go see his family and got on a train and left town. But conceivably, all four of them, and Seward himself was really quite an easy target. He was in his home on Lafayette Square there in Washington. He'd been injured a couple weeks earlier in a carriage accident, so he was immobile. There, again, was no armed guard at the door. The assassin was able to talk his way past the servant. He was able to club Seward's son to near death outside Seward's door. And he burst into Seward's room with a pistol in one hand and a gun in the other. It's a miracle that Seward survived.
How did he survive?
Well, the pistol wasn't working because the assassin, Powell, had used it as a club to club Frederick Seward outside the door. The knife was working quite well. The knife was actually recently displayed. It belongs to the Huntington Museum out in California, and it's a terrifying knife. The assassin, however, kind of went for the big theatrical motion of slashing down, and Seward was able to kind of roll out of the way. He was slashed a couple times about the face and neck, but he, fortunately, the critical arteries weren't severed, and he rolled off the bed, and the screams of his daughter brought some men into the room who wrestled the assassin out the door.
You know, it's amazing to me that this story of Seward and the potential assassination of Andrew Johnson, of course, they've been subsumed over the years by what happened to Abraham Lincoln. But this is just such a spectacular story. And the whole notion of the top ranks of the U.S. government going down in one night has sort of been overlooked for so many years. I'm wondering, why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's partly just that, you know, we have such a strong focus on Lincoln as we focus, you know, on those years, and also that, I think if all of those people had been killed, then there would be perhaps a little bit more of a focus on all of them rather than just Lincoln. But Seward survives, Johnson survives, Grant survives, and so we tend to forget their brush with death on that night.
We're visiting with Walter Starr about his new book, Seward, Lincoln's Indispensable Man. I'm just wondering, how did the events of that night affect Seward in his later years? I mean, certainly a moment like that has got to change a man.
It did. He never fully regained his strength. He bore the scars. There's the last picture in my picture insert is I think one of maybe two photographs of him post that time, and shows just the sort of terrible damage to his face and neck. And his wife, who was with him on that night, not in the room but in the house, and who then sort of nursed Seward and their son back to health, the strain of it, the horror of it, killed her within a couple weeks, and so he faces the rest of his life without the support of his beloved, the support, and I should say even sort of political advice of his very astute and political wife.
Now, you said, Walter, that you became intrigued by William Seward as a result of reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's book. What intrigued you so much about him as a result of reading that book?
Well, she does a great job of dealing with the war years and the cabinet, but of necessity, she doesn't have much about kind of Seward as a younger man, as governor, as senator.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, there's got to be more there. I mean, I would just, the question of, how does this man become governor of New York, the most populous state, at such a tender age, was one that came to me. And I knew, almost everyone knows that Seward survives and goes on to purchase Alaska and sort of, well, how does that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And why does he stay in the administration of Andrew Johnson, a man very unlike Lincoln? So it was in part to kind of deal with the other periods. And I felt that even in the Civil War, there were probably things, I didn't know what they were, but I felt there were probably things that she didn't have space to talk about. And lo and behold, as I dug into it, I found such things.
Just a quick programming note. President Obama will speak about the nation's finances at noon today. KCUR will join NPR for live coverage and analysis. Again, the president speaks at noon today. This segment we're visiting with Walter Starr about his new book about William Seward. It's titled Seward, Lincoln's Indispensable Man. Why did William Seward then, Walter, how do you end up losing the Republican nomination in 1860 to this unknown senator from Illinois named Abraham Lincoln? Because, Seward started out as the huge favorite to win this thing. He's from New York. He's twice elected governor. And then he winds up losing to a guy most Americans had never heard of.
One of the sort of great upsets of American political history. There are a couple of things. There's sort of some tactical things, and then there may be some bigger things. On the tactical level, the convention was held in Chicago, and that allowed Lincoln's friends to arrange things in ways that benefited Lincoln. So, for example, on the day of the voting, they handed out a lot of fake tickets to locals, and so the crowd was very pro-Lincoln, and many of Seward's supporters couldn't even get into the hall. On the sort of bigger plane, I think that Lincoln and Seward at the time had very similar positions on the slavery issue, but Seward had been talking about it for much longer, and people were concerned that he would be perceived as a radical, whereas Lincoln, he wasn't by any matter of means a blank slate on that issue. He had given his famous House Divided speech, but he was perceived as being more moderate. Another major issue was the Catholic vote, or maybe I should say the anti-Catholic vote. Within the Republican Party, there were many people who had been know-nothings in the election of 1856, anti-Catholics. And Seward was known as a friend of the Catholics. As governor, he had made a huge cause of the education of Catholic children in New York City. There were a lot of people who didn't like that and who were not going to vote for Seward, and so Seward would have had difficulty if he'd been the nominee carrying states like Pennsylvania and New Jersey.
Hmm. Again, Walter Starr is our guest. We're talking about William Seward, Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of State. So let's fast forward here a bit. Walter, Seward joins the administration. Lincoln brings him in. How long did it take for Lincoln and Seward to begin bonding? Because they become very close friends. How long does that process take?
Well, certainly the first few months are rocky. Seward disagrees with Lincoln about the major policy issue facing the administration in the first few weeks, namely what to do about Fort Sumter. Seward thinks that the Union should abandon it. Almost all the other southern forts by that time are in the hands of the rebels. One fort in Charleston Harbor, essentially indefensible. It'd be better, in Seward's view, to sort of get the public relations benefit of handing the keys to the rebels than try to defend it. So they disagree on that issue. They disagree on some other points early on. But they, as they begin to spend more time together, they begin to appreciate one another. And say by the end of 1861, in the midst of the Trent crisis, it's very clear how much Lincoln relies upon his Secretary of State, his friend by that point, Seward, for foreign and domestic advice.
And before long, isn't Lincoln walking across the street? Seward lives right across the street from the White House. Lincoln walks over in the evenings, just sort of sit and chat and talk things over. And I'm thinking, boy, wouldn't you love to have a tape recording of at least one of those conversations? Wouldn't that be amazing?
Yes, I would give much for the ability to have a tape recording, particularly because they were together so much. There's very little by way of written material between Lincoln and Seward for a historian to work with. And so we rely on things like Lincoln's secretary, John Hay, who mm-hmm. notes down a couple of these conversations in his diary, or Seward's son, Frederick, who recalled some of them after the war. But yes, it would be wonderful to have some more details of some of those conversations. But we do get some glimpses. Seward's daughter, Fanny, comes to Washington a couple times during the war, and she records, spending time with the president both at the Seward House and over at the White House, and the two men would not infrequently in the late afternoon get in a carriage and go out to see the military units around mm-hmm. Washington. Indeed, I was able to find at the Massachusetts Historical Society a letter home from a Boston colonel describing how he was just going about his business one afternoon and saw a couple carriages, and lo and behold, here are the president and the secretary of state and the whole Seward family descended upon him unannounced for an inspection.
Yeah, there's a story you tell about the two of them walking into meetings together laughing. Do you recount that that moment?
Yeah, the others in the cabinet, pretty soon came to dislike Seward because they felt that he was kind of, he and the president were making decisions, on their own ahead of the cabinet meeting, and then coming in sharing a story just a chuckle, and they had the sense that whatever they were about to quote consider as the cabinet had really kind of been considered and decided by Seward and Lincoln. Wells, the Secretary of Navy, complained once to his diary that on important matters, the only person whom the president consulted was Seward.
Where was Seward on the issue of freeing the slaves?
That's one point on which I kind of differ with most accounts, including Doris Kearns Goodwin. Most accounts quote him at the first cabinet meeting to debate that, as saying that he approved the Emancipation Proclamation, but he questioned the timing. I think, based on various sources, including Stanton's notes of that meeting, that what he said was more like, don't do it, but for God's sake, if you're going to do it, don't do it right now, which is a rather different thing. He was worried about various things. He was worried about the possibility of slaves rising up and slaughtering their masters. He was worried about losing the political support of the border states. He was worried about the attitude of the foreign countries. By the time of the final Emancipation Proclamation at the first of the year, I think he'd come around. But I think his initial attitude was more negative than it usually is portrayed.
We're talking about William Seward, Lincoln's Secretary of State and a key member of Abraham Lincoln's team of rivals. Why was the purchase of Alaska referred to as Seward's folly, Walter?
I don't think was referred to as Seward's folly. I spent quite a while reading newspapers from the couple weeks right after the treaty was announced, And the initial reaction was quite favorable. Roughly a year later, as Seward tried to persuade the House of Representatives, the Senate ratified the treaty quite quickly. But then it took a long time for the House to get around to appropriating the $7.2 million, the promised purchase price. And at that point, the press commentary becomes more critical. I think it's largely because people realize that Alaska isn't the only thing Seward has in his sights. He wants to acquire British Columbia, and he wants to acquire Hawaii, and there's even a rumor, which we now know has some truth, that he has his eyes on Greenland and Iceland.
Wow.
Yes. Midway through the House debate, someone says, I have a report in my hands about the value of Greenland and Iceland. And that report, which exists, was prepared at Seward's request. So people began to think, we have to pay the bills for this war. We really can't afford to be buying up, as one newspaper critic puts it, the whole hemisphere from from Tierra del Fuego up to the Arctic Circle. So the criticism was not quite so much of Alaska per se, but of Seward's general territorial ambitions.
You wind up concluding that William Seward was the greatest statesman of the 19th century. And I'm wondering, even more so than Henry Clay or Daniel Webster, is he that high up?
Well, I've had some debates with friends who are partisans of Clay and Webster. I'm here at Phillips Exeter, which is Webster's alma mater.
Hometown territory up there, yeah.
I think, Seward served as Secretary of State for 8 years. Webster's service is much shorter. If you look at sort of what he accomplishes, not just Alaska, but the kind of markers that he leaves on other bits of territory, other relationships, our relationships with Japan and China, I think that he should rank higher than those gentlemen. And indeed, it happens less often, but occasionally there are surveys of historians as to, who was our greatest Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
And he generally ranks second only to his mentor,
John Quincy Adams. Yeah.
Who becomes president and thus, in a way, has some other advantages.
Again, Walter Starr will speak about William Seward and his book, Seward, Lincoln's Indispensable Man, at 6:30 next Tuesday night at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the branch downtown at 14 West 10th Street. Go to kclibrary.org for more information. Walter, thanks so much for your time today. Great having you.
Great being on the show, Steve. Thanks so much.
You bet.